This CLE course is based on the New York State appellate decisions that were released in May of 2019 and dealt with issues related to negligence. The summaries that make up this CLE were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in May of 2019, and they have since been compiled into an update pamphlet, and it is that May 2019 negligence update pamphlet which constitutes the written materials for this CLE course. The pamphlet is available on the New York Appellate Digest website. The first case in the pamphlet is Critch on page 8, and it deals with assumption of risk. Fourth Department held defendant Golfer's motion for summary judgment was properly denied. There was evidence that the defendant teed off when plaintiff was in the range of defendant's normal drives. Plaintiff was struck in the head by the ball. This was not a case of a mishit ball, which would trigger the assumption of risk doctrine. The court wrote, defendant's submissions raise an issue of fact whether he unreasonably increased the risk of striking plaintiff with his golf ball by teeing off when plaintiff, who was visible in the fairway on the same hole, was still positioned well within the typical range of defendant's drive. Next is the Toher case, T-O-H-E-R. It's on page 9. It's a dog bite case. And as you know, dog bite cases are analyzed under a strict liability theory, not a negligence theory. But this court briefly addressed the fact that common law negligence principles are not applicable to a dog bite case, so I included the case here. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the landlord's motion for summary judgment in this dog bite case should have been granted. The landlord was aware the tenant had a dog and could have required the removal of the dog, but was not aware whether the dog had vicious propensities. The court noted that theories of common law negligence do not apply in dog bite cases. Next, on page 10, is the MF case. It's another assumption of risk case. This time a student sued the school district. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this negligent supervision action, held that plaintiff student assumed the risk of injury from a blocking sled during football practice. Plaintiff was not feeling well and was on the sidelines watching the practice. He was not paying attention when a blocking sled pushed by several players veered toward him and ran over his foot. The court noted that the assumption of risk doctrine applies to bystanders and spectators. The court wrote, the defendant submitted evidence that the plaintiff fully comprehended the risks inherent in the sport of football, specifically that a blocking sled could veer to the left or to the right while it was being used in a drill. Next is Motta, M-O-T-T-A, on page 11. It's another lawsuit against a school. Third Department held that a new trial was necessary because of an inconsistency in the jury's answers on the verdict sheet. The trial court attempted to cure the inconsistency after the jury was discharged by speaking with the jury foreman, who was still in the courthouse when the problem was noticed. The jury had awarded the plaintiff student $1 million in a negligent supervision suit against the school district stemming from bullying by other students. And that's the reason I included the case in this negligence pamphlet. The issue really relates to the proper procedure for dealing with an inconsistent verdict. But I thought the $1 million verdict for negligent supervision in a bullying case was worth bringing to your attention. Next, is the BJ case on page 12. It's another lawsuit against the school alleging negligent supervision. Second department held that the plaintiff student's negligent supervision action against the Board of Education was properly dismissed. The plaintiff was injured during lacrosse practice when a dog brought into the field area by a non-student broke loose and chased a student who then ran into the plaintiff. The court wrote, "The defendants established that they had no specific knowledge of any prior instances of dogs being brought into the field area during sports practices. Furthermore, the act of a student running into the infant plaintiff was spontaneous, impulsive, and intervening act that could not have been anticipated. Therefore, the defendants established that any alleged lack of supervision was not a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries." Next is the Evans case on pages 12 and 13. It involves employment law and the Espinal factors, where in some cases a contractual relationship can result in a tort. The first department held that the restaurant's name was Dolphins. The restaurant's motion for summary judgment in this action alleging negligence on the part of a valet parking service that was called APV, with which the restaurant had contracted, was properly denied. The court said, "A restaurant providing valet parking services can be held liable for the negligence of the service whose attendants are alleged to have caused an accident to a third party. This is the case even where the service is an independent contractor with which the restaurant contracted. The duty arises under the Espinal case when there is an ability and opportunity to control the conduct of the restaurant's contractors and an awareness of the need to do so. Dolphin cannot assert that it signed a contract with the valet parking service and then covered its eyes with a blindfold. Rather, Dolphin was required to select a company with, at the minimum, both appropriate insurance and competent drivers. Defendant restaurant was able to decline to enter into any contract for valet services it felt insufficient and therefore in the best position to protect against the risk of harm. Dolphin similarly failed to demonstrate that it did not create an unreasonable risk of harm to others, or that APV entirely displaced its duty to maintain the valet parking area safely. Those are the Espinal factors, which give rise to a tort based on a contractual relationship. The court went on, "The evidence showed that the restaurant and the valet service communicated on a daily basis to determine proper staffing. The parties' agreement similarly provided that service was provided as requested by the restaurant, and that it was the restaurant's obligation to provide the schedule for each week. Dolphin may also be liable under the doctrine of ostensible agency or apparent authority, and thus estopped from denying liability for an entity it held out as its agent." Next is the Mullen case on pages 13 and 14. It's a negligent supervision and retention employment-related action. The second department, modifying Supreme Court, held that the medical records of a non-party witness were discoverable only to the extent that they included non-privileged information demonstrating defendant Huntington Medical Group, that's HMG, was on notice that the defendant doctor, Wishner, had acted improperly with patients. Plaintiff sued HMG, alleging negligent hiring, supervision, and retention of the doctor, Wishner. Plaintiff had deposed a non-party witness who apparently had alleged improper conduct by Wishner. The defendant sought to discover the non-party witness's medical records. Second department noted that the defendants, one, had not shown the medical records were relevant to the improper conduct allegations, and two, the non-party witness had not waived the physician-patient privilege, So the matter was remitted for an in-camera review of the records by the Supreme Court, and only material that was not privileged could be released. Next case is the Williams case on page 15. It's another case related to employment. Third Department held plaintiff's vicarious liability causes of action against the employer of the driver of a company truck which struck plaintiff's car head-on properly survived summary judgment. The driver, whose name was Price, was intoxicated and was convicted of vehicular assault. The employer argued that because of the company policy prohibiting employees from using drugs and alcohol, Price did not have permission to operate the truck within the meaning of Vehicle and Traffic Law 388. The employer also argued Price was not acting within the scope of his employment when the accident occurred, but the court found there were questions of fact on both of those issues. The court wrote, "The requirement to drive sober relates more closely to the manner of operation or how to drive rather than a restriction on who may operate the vehicle and when and where they may do so, as defendants did not establish as a matter of law that Price was driving without permission at the time of the accident, they were not entitled to summary judgment on the Vehicle and Traffic Law 388 claim. Price testified that his employer gave him a vehicle to use for business purposes, including traveling from home to work, and at the time of the accident, he was driving to a job site to begin work for the day. The employer arguably derived a benefit from Price's ability to take the vehicle home because the truck contained a toolbox for work tools. He used the truck to transport supplies to the job sites. The truck advertised the business by displaying the company name and logo, and he worked at construction job sites rather than the main office. So permitting him to take the vehicle home saved him from having to use work time to pick the company truck up and drop it off at a central location each day. Based on this evidence, defendants failed to establish their entitlement to summary judgment, as there was a factual question regarding whether Price was acting within the scope of his employment at the time of the accident." Next is the Acox case. It's a labor law 241 and 241-6 case, so it's not primarily a negligence action. However, in addition to the labor law causes of action, there were causes of action based on negligence and wrongful death, so I included the case here. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the plaintiff, who fell through a hole in a house under construction, was not engaged in an activity covered by Labor Law 241 or 241-6 when he fell. Plaintiff was measuring windows for future installation of window treatments, which is not construction work. But there were questions of fact on both the negligence and the wrongful death causes of action. So the negligence causes of action survived the summary judgment motion despite the dismissal of the labor law causes of action. Next is the Gatto case, G-A-T-T-O, on pages 16 and 17. It has to do with liability for a dangerous condition in a rented premises. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that the defendant, Coin Match, which leased a laundry room, was not entitled to summary judgment in this personal injury case. Plaintiff alleged the soap tray on the washing machine in the leased laundry room. The soap tray on the washing machine she was using came all the way out of the machine when she pulled it open, which caused her to fall backward from an elevated step which was in front of the machine. The Second Department held that Coin Match, again the lessee of the laundry room, could be held liable because it was responsible for maintaining the laundry room. The court also held that Coin Match did not eliminate questions of fact concerning its constructive notice of the defect, which caused the tray to pull out of the machine because there was no evidence when the machine was last inspected. So this is another example of that recurrent issue in summary judgment motions based on dangerous conditions. A defendant must affirmatively demonstrate that it did not have notice of the dangerous condition, and in order to prove the absence of constructive notice, it's essential that the defendant indicate in its papers when the particular condition or area was last inspected or repaired. Next is the Burbacki case. It's a legal malpractice case involving bankruptcy. Second Department held plaintiff did not have the capacity to sue the defendant attorneys for legal malpractice. The lawsuit alleged the attorneys gave inaccurate advice, which caused plaintiff to file for bankruptcy on March 20, 2012. Because plaintiff's legal malpractice action accrued on the day she filed for bankruptcy, and the lawsuit was not listed as an asset when she filed for bankruptcy, the lawsuit became part of the bankruptcy estate. The court wrote, "The commencement of a bankruptcy proceeding creates an estate that is comprised of all legal or equitable interests of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case." That's 11 U.S.C. Section 541A1. "Upon the filing of a voluntary bankruptcy petition, all property which a debtor owns, including a cause of action, vests in the bankruptcy estate. Although federal law determines when a debtor's interest in property is property of the bankruptcy estate, property interests are created and defined by state law. Causes of action that accrue under state law prior to the filing of a bankruptcy petition, as well as those that accrue as a result of the filing, are property of the estate. A debtor's failure to list a legal claim as an asset in his or her bankruptcy proceeding causes the claim to remain the property of the bankruptcy estate and precludes the debtor from pursuing the claim on his or her own behalf." Next is the Mancuso case on pages 18 and 19. It's a medical malpractice case, and it involves CPLR Article 16. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held defendant hospital was properly precluded from presenting a CPLR Article 16 defense in this medical malpractice action. And again, the Article 16 defense allows a party deemed 50% liable or less to pay only that portion of the damages. Plaintiff's decedent was first treated at defendant hospital and then at defendant rehabilitation facilities, which is called the Elderwoods. When plaintiff's decedent was treated at the hospital, she was given a high dosage of medication, simvastatin, and that high dosage was continued at the Elderwoods. The dosage was four times higher than plaintiff's decedent's usual dosage. The high dosage caused plaintiff's decedent's extreme suffering and death. Earlier in the litigation, the Elderwoods moved for severance. The defendant opposed, and the motion was denied. As the trial approached, defendant moved to sever the Elderwoods and represented to the court that the Elderwoods' involvement would not be a topic in the main action. The Elderwoods subsequently stipulated to the severance. Then, at the trial, after plaintiff rested, defendant gave notice that it would present evidence of the Elderwoods' negligence and asked to have them included on the verdict sheet pursuant to CPLR Article 16. Noting that the plaintiff was not able to address the Article 16 defense during the jury selection and trial, the Fourth Department held that the defendant was properly precluded from presenting the defense. The court also noted that the defendant's request for an error in judgment jury instruction was properly denied. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that the fact that the third-party action was severed does not extinguish a defendant's Article 16 defense. But in this case, defendant represented before the court, before the trial started, that the topic of care at the Elderwoods would not be discussed. If defendant had not made this representation, then plaintiff could have preempted or otherwise addressed this anticipated defense through opening statements and plaintiff's own lay and expert witnesses in plaintiff's case in chief, and thus could have suggested that the Elderwoods were not negligent before arresting. As plaintiff's counsel asserts, he could have examined his witnesses at trial differently had he known that the topic of the Elderwoods' care and thus the CPLR Article 16 defense was still on the table. The Fourth Department then went on to consider the question of whether the defense was entitled to an error in judgment charge, jury charge. The court said, "It is well settled that a doctor may be liable only if the doctor's treatment decisions do not reflect his or her own best judgment or fall short of the generally accepted standard of care. An error in judgment charge is appropriate only in a narrow category of medical malpractice cases in which there is evidence that defendant physician considered and chose among several medically acceptable treatment alternatives. This case does not fall within that narrow category. There was simply no evidence that there was any judgment made by hospital personnel to administer 80 milligrams daily of simvastatin to the decedent." At this point, I'm going to insert the first verification code for this May 29, 2019 negligence update CLE course. The first verification code is error. Again, the first verification code for this May 2019 negligence update CLE course is error. Next is the Hutchinson case on pages 19 and 20. It stands for a fundamental rule that I'm sure most people understand, but it keeps cropping up in the appellate cases, so I included it here. It's a medical malpractice case concerning expert opinion. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this medical malpractice action, held that plaintiff's expert affidavit raised questions of fact about whether defendant's treatment of plaintiff's decedent departed from accepted standards of care. Granting summary judgment to defendants is not appropriate where there are conflicting medical opinions. Next is the Jeter case, J-E-T-E-R. It's on pages 20 and 21. It's another medical malpractice case, and it deals with the determination whether the case sounds in medical malpractice or in negligence. Second Department held plaintiff's action against defendant hospital sounded in medical malpractice, not negligence, and plaintiff's motion to amend the complaint to add a medical malpractice cause of action and other allegations should have been granted in its entirety. Plaintiff suffered memory loss after surgery and repeatedly threatened to leave the hospital. She did in fact leave and was not found for 5 days. The Second Department determined the failure to supervise plaintiff was an element of her treatment and therefore the actions sounded in medical malpractice. The court wrote, "When the complaint challenges the medical facility's performance of functions that are an integral part of the process of rendering medical treatment and diagnosis to a patient, such as taking a medical history and determining the need for restraints, it sounds in medical malpractice. The allegations at issue essentially challenge the hospital's assessment of the plaintiff's supervisory and treatment needs. Thus, the conduct at issue derived from the duty owed to the plaintiff as a result of a physician-patient relationship and was substantially related to her medical treatment." Next is Matter of Rodriguez on pages 21 and 22. It's a third-party assault case, and it involves municipal law and the adequacy of a notice of claim. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the petitioner's motion to serve a late notice of claim should have been granted. Petitioner, a medical technician, alleged she was struck by an inmate in the custody of the Department of Correction while the inmate was being treated at Bellevue Hospital. The petitioner reported and discussed the incident with a Department of Correction captain on the day it happened and sought to file the notice of claim 7 months late. The court wrote, Supreme Court presumably agreed with respondent's argument that it lacked notice because petitioner never specified that she had told the Department of Correction captain the manner in which the Department of Correction was negligent, namely by failing to ensure that a correction officer was present when she spoke with the inmate. We disagree. To the extent that petitioner did not establish actual notice because she did not specify that her description of the assault included a recitation of who was in the room, municipal authorities have an obligation to obtain the missing information if that can be done with a modicum of effort. Here, negligence is the only theory of liability that could be implied by petitioner's conversation with the Department of Correction captain, and in any event, he could have determined who was in the room during the course of his investigation with a modicum of effort. To hold otherwise would turn the statute into a sword contrary to its remedial purpose. Respondent never provided Supreme Court with any evidence to substantiate that it was prejudiced by the mere passage of time. Instead, respondent made generic arguments and inferences which cannot establish substantial prejudice in the absence of facts in the record to support such a finding. While petitioner did not demonstrate a reasonable excuse for service of her late notice of claim, the lack of excuse is not fatal here. Next is the Wright case on pages 22 and 23. It's a negligent entrustment action. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the vehicle and traffic law cause of action should have been dismissed, but the negligent entrustment cause of action properly survived summary judgment. Plaintiff's 16-year-old son was injured when defendant's utility vehicle, driven on private property by defendant's 14-year-old son, overturned. The court wrote, for purposes of Section 388, that's the vehicle and traffic law, vehicle means a motor vehicle which is defined as every vehicle operated or driven upon a public highway which is propelled by any power other than muscular power. A public highway is any highway, road, street, avenue, alley, public place, public driveway, or any other public way, citing Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 134. At the time of the incident, the utility vehicle was being operated on defendant's private property, not a public highway. Accordingly, we find that the utility vehicle was not a motor vehicle within the meaning of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 125, and it was error for Supreme Court to conclude otherwise. The court went on, Supreme Court did not err in denying summary judgment on the negligent entrustment cause of action. A parent owes a duty to protect third parties from harm that is clearly foreseeable from the child's improvident use or operation of a dangerous instrument where such use is found to be subject to the parent's control. The submissions reveal that the defendant's son was not always required to ask for permission to operate the utility vehicle, and the submissions fail to show that the defendant had knowledge of how his son, when outside of his presence, operated the vehicle. This proof, together with the clear warnings in the operator's manual, fails to support a determination as a matter of law that defendants could not have clearly foreseen that their 14-year-old son's recreational use of the utility could have exposed others to injury. The next case is Deschamps on page 24. It has several issues, whether a condition is open and obvious, but more importantly, whether a dangerous condition is the proximate cause of the injury. Second Department, held the allegations that defendants were operating a tree trimming business without a license and negligently entrusted the tree trimming to one Perez, with whom plaintiff worked, were not proximate causes of the injury. Plaintiff caught a ring on his finger on a spike on a metal step on the truck used for the tree trimming, and his finger was severed. The court wrote, "Evidence of negligence is not enough by itself to establish liability. It must also be proved that the negligence was a proximate cause of the event which produced the harm. Therefore, liability may not be imposed upon a party who merely furnishes the condition or occasion for the occurrence of the event, but is not one of its causes. Even if the defendants were negligent in operating a tree trimming business without a license, or in lending or renting or entrusting the truck to Perez, such negligent acts only furnished the occasion for the plaintiff's accident, but were not a proximate cause of the accident." Next is the Sampaio-Lopes case, which is on pages 25 and 26. It's a slip and fall case that raises the Espinal issues. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall should not have been granted. The plaintiff leased the ground floor apartment and defendant leased the second floor apartment. Plaintiff slipped and fell on ice on the exterior front steps of the two-family house. Defendant demonstrated she had a contractual arrangement with the property owner to remove ice and snow, and because plaintiff was not a party to the agreement, no duty of care was owed to the plaintiff. And the court noted that no Espinal factors were alleged by the plaintiff in her complaint. But the plaintiff raised questions of fact about an applicable Espinal factor in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment. The court wrote, "A contractual obligation standing alone would generally not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third party. However, the Court of Appeals has recognized three exceptions to the general rule. One, where the contracting party, in failing to exercise reasonable care in the performance of his or her duties, launches a force or instrument of harm. Two, where the plaintiff detrimentally relies on the continued performance of the contracting party's duties. And three, where the contracting party has entirely displaced the other party's duty to maintain the premises safely." Here, the court went on. "The plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether defendant's oral agreement with the property owner regarding maintenance was comprehensive and exclusive so as to entirely displace the property owner's duty to maintain the exterior front steps and the gutter. In addition, the plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether the defendant had actual notice of an alleged recurrent dangerous condition regarding ice formation on the steps due to the leaky gutter and was thus chargeable with constructive notice of each specific occurrence of the condition." So again, although the plaintiff did not include any Espinal allegations in the complaint, she raised the question whether the defendant had completely taken over the property owner's duty to maintain the property in her opposition to the defendant's motion for summary judgment. Next is the Espeleta case, Espeleta, on page 26. It's another slip and fall case that at least considered the Espinal factors, although it didn't apply them. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant, which had contracted with plaintiff's employer to offer a work training program, did not owe a duty of care to the plaintiff who tripped and fell over extension cord wires during the training session. The only Espinal exception alleged was that the defendant launched an instrument of harm, which was deemed inapplicable by the Second Department. The alleged failure to eliminate the tripping hazard was not actionable. The court said, Supreme Court's determination that a triable issue of fact existed as to whether the defendant negligently failed to correct the alleged tripping hazard amounts to a finding that the defendant may have merely failed to become an instrument of good, which is insufficient to impose a duty of care upon a party not in privity of contract with the injured party. So the evidence here didn't show that the tripping hazard was created by the defendant. It apparently only showed that the tripping hazard was not corrected by the defendant. Next is Barrios, which is on page 27, another slip and fall case involving municipal law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the abutting landowner, name was Glinton, in this slip and fall case did not have a duty to maintain the sidewalk tree well where the plaintiff fell. The court wrote, Administrative Code of the City of New York, section 7-210, which became effective in 2003, shifted tort liability for injuries arising from a defective sidewalk from the city to the abutting property owner. However, a tree well does not fall within the applicable Administrative Code definition of sidewalk, and thus Section 7-210 does not impose civil liability on property owners for injuries that occur in city-owned tree wells. Next is Eisenberg on pages 27 and 28, another slip and fall case involving municipal law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the town's motion for summary judgment in this sidewalk slip and fall case should not have been granted. Although the town did not have written notice of the dangerous condition, the town did not demonstrate it didn't create the dangerous condition by piling snow that melted and refroze. The court wrote, the defendant's evidence provided information about its general snow removal operations, but failed to show what the sidewalk abutting the accident site looked like immediately after it completed its snow removal operations. The defendant failed to establish that the 6 to 12 inches of snow that the plaintiff saw on the sidewalk, making it impassable, was not the product of its snow removal operations. The defendant also failed to submit any evidence as to what the temperature was from the time that it last performed its snow removal operations on January 24th and the time of the accident. Next is Harvish on pages 28 and 29, another slip and fall involving municipal law. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant city's motion for summary judgment in this sidewalk slip and fall case should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged a sign which had been installed in the sidewalk was missing, and she tripped over the protruding sign anchor. The city demonstrated it did not have written notice of the condition, and the plaintiff was unable to show the condition was the immediate effect of action taken by the city. The court wrote, plaintiff claimed that defendant affirmatively created the defect by improperly installing the sign in 2006 and failing to routinely monitor its condition thereafter. However, the affirmative negligence exception to prior written notice statutes applies only where the action of the municipality immediately results in the existence of a dangerous condition. Plaintiff failed to present any proof establishing that defendant engaged in an activity that immediately resulted in the detachment of the sign and the sign pole from its anchor. Next is the Allen case, which is on page 29, another slip and fall case, this time involving the storm in progress rule. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the New York City Transit Authority was entitled to summary judgment in this slip and fall case pursuant to the storm in progress rule. The evidence did not support plaintiff's allegation that ice had formed before the storm. The court wrote, here the evidence that the New York City Transit Authority submitted in support of its motion, including a transcript of the plaintiff's testimony at her 50H hearing, a transcript of plaintiff's deposition testimony, and certified climatological data demonstrated that the subject accident occurred while a storm was in progress. In this regard, the plaintiff testified that it was snowing at the time of the accident, and the certified climatological data confirms that testimony. In opposition, the plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact. Her contention that she slipped and fell on ice that existed prior to the storm that was in progress on the date of the accident was based on speculation and conjecture. The plaintiff presented no evidence, expert or otherwise, that the ice on which she fell was not produced by the storm in progress on the day of the accident. Next is Muzio, M-U-Z-I-O, on page 30, another slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant school district did not demonstrate that it didn't have constructive notice of the icy condition in this slip and fall case. Although the district demonstrated it removed snow and slush from the area as late as January 6th, it did not demonstrate that it inspected or cleaned the area between January 6th and January 9th when the plaintiff fell. Next is the Latour case on page 31, another slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant condominium's motion for summary judgment in this ice slip and fall case should not have been granted. The defendant didn't demonstrate when the area had last been inspected. The court wrote, a property owner will be held liable for a slip and fall accident involving snow and ice on its property only when it created the dangerous condition which caused the accident or had actual or constructive notice of its existence. A defendant who moves for summary judgment in a slip and fall case has the initial burden of making a prima facie showing that it neither created the hazardous condition nor had actual or constructive notice of its existence for a sufficient length of time to discover and remedy it. To meet its initial burden on the issue of lack of constructive notice, a defendant must offer some evidence as to when the area in question was last cleaned or inspected relative to the time when the plaintiff fell. Here, the defendant failed to establish that it did not have constructive notice of the alleged patches of ice. In support of its motion, the defendant submitted the deposition testimony of the managing agent of the property, who merely testified about his general inspection practices and provided no evidence regarding any specific inspection of the areas in question prior to the plaintiff's falls. Next is Pagan on page 32, another slip and fall. Second Department held that the defendant New York City Housing Authority's motion for summary judgment in this stairway slip and fall case was properly granted. Plaintiff alleged that she slipped on a wet condition that was recurrent. The New York City Housing Authority presented evidence that the stairway had been inspected the morning of the accident, and that there had been no prior complaints about a wet condition. Next is Valenta, which is on pages 32 and 33. Another slip and fall. The First Department held that the defendant restaurant's summary judgment motion in this slip and fall case was properly granted. The restaurant demonstrated the floor had been inspected 10 minutes before plaintiff fell, and the floor had been cleaned the night before. The court wrote, defendants established that they neither created the dangerous condition nor had actual or constructive notice of its existence for a sufficient length of time to discover and remedy it. Among other things, defendant's manager received no complaints concerning the floor and saw nothing on the floor when he inspected in the morning or later, around 10 minutes before plaintiff fell. The evidence that neither plaintiff nor defendant's employees saw the slippery substance on the floor until after plaintiff fell demonstrates that it was not sufficiently visible and apparent to charge defendants with constructive notice. Furthermore, Testimony by defendant's manager that the porter cleaned the restaurant floor every night with a solution of water and vinegar is sufficient to establish a lack of constructive notice. In opposition, plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact. Plaintiff's speculation that her fall could have been caused by the porter's use of a vinegar and water mixture to clean the floors is insufficient to sustain a cause of action. The wet or greasy substance on the floor of a busy restaurant was a transient condition that could have appeared at any point after the porter finished cleaning the floors in the morning. Next case is Kontorinakis, Kontorinakis. It's on pages 33 and 34. It's another slip and fall, and it deals with the adequacy of evidence to get by a summary judgment motion. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. The complaint alleged plaintiff's decedent tripped over a raised portion of a sidewalk. The evidence included plaintiff's decedent's explanation of the cause of the fall as described by plaintiff's wife. Defendants argued plaintiffs could not prove the cause of the fall because decedent's statements were inadmissible hearsay. The Second Department noted that hearsay is admissible in opposition to a summary judgment motion as long as it's not the only evidence. Here there was circumstantial evidence of the cause of the fall. The court wrote, the defendants failed to establish their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by eliminating all triable issues of fact. They failed to demonstrate that the cause of decedent's fall could not be established by admissible evidence, either direct or circumstantial. Further, since the defendants failed to submit evidence as to when they last inspected the sidewalk, they failed to establish a lack of constructive notice of the allegedly defective condition of the sidewalk. Next is the Bayaha case on page 34. It deals with the way to analyze a summary judgment motion. First Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held that questions of fact precluded summary judgment. The plaintiff's and the defendant's versions of events, which are vastly different, are explained in detail in the decision. Plaintiff, who was in the back of an ambulette with a patient in a wheelchair, alleged that the driver pulled out fast, causing plaintiff to fall and causing the wheelchair to tip over onto plaintiff. The driver alleged he had fastened the wheelchair to the floor of the ambulette and made sure plaintiff was strapped into his seat. He further alleged that he drove safely, but the driver acknowledged that the wheelchair had tipped over backwards. The court said, we disagree with the dissent's statement that the defendants have failed to offer any explanation of the proximate cause of the accident. It's plaintiff's burden as the moving party for a summary judgment to establish defendant's negligence as a proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries. Here, defendants adequately rebutted plaintiff's claim of negligence on their part, and thus plaintiff has failed to establish defendant's negligence and proximate cause. If a trier of fact finds defendant's version of events to be credible, then no liability would be imposed on them. Next is the Lanfranchi case, which is on page 35. It's a third-party assault case, apparently a bar fight. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this third-party assault bar fight case should have been granted. Defendant didn't strike the plaintiff and was not under a duty to protect plaintiff from the conduct of others. The court said, generally, there is no duty to control the conduct of third persons to prevent them from causing injury to others. Next is the Rosner case, which is on pages 36 and 37. It's a toxic torts case involving real estate. Second Department held that the defendant sellers were not liable under breach of contract or negligence theories for the presence of mold and mice in a house sold to plaintiffs. The court wrote, a simple breach of contract is not to be considered a tort unless a legal duty independent of the contract itself has been violated. A claim for negligent misrepresentation requires the plaintiffs to demonstrate, one, the existence of a special privity-like relationship imposing a duty on the defendants to impart correct information to the plaintiffs, two, that the information was incorrect, and three, reasonable reliance on the information. Here, the defendants demonstrated that there was no special or privity-like relationship between themselves and the plaintiffs in this arm's-length transaction. Next is the Arias case on page 37. It's another toxic torts case. First Department held that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this toxic tort case was properly denied. Plaintiff, an evening cleaner in an office building, alleged she was injured by inhaling toxic fumes from a paint stripping product used by a defendant's subcontractor. The subcontractor's name is Island Painting. The court wrote, the defendant failed to establish that it did not have actual or constructive notice of the alleged dangerous condition of the premises in time to take corrective measures. Defendant submitted no evidence with respect to notice. There is evidence in the record that defendant had superintendents on site who oversaw the subcontractor's work undertaken on the project so as to safeguard the building's occupants against exposure to such hazards. Issues of fact exist as to whether defendant knew of the scheduled use of the paint stripper and of the product's toxicity and yet failed to warn the building owner and occupants to prevent harm to them. These issues of fact as to negligence also preclude summary judgment in defendant's favor on its claim for contractual indemnification by the subcontractor Island Painting. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code for this May 2019 negligence update CLE course. The second verification code is toxic. Again, the second verification code for this May 2019 negligence update CLE course is toxic. Next is the Kleiber case on page 38. It's basically a trial procedure case. It's a traffic accident, went to trial. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion pursuant to CPLR 4404A to set aside the jury verdict in this personal injury case should not have been granted. The trial judge granted the motion in the interest of justice, primarily based upon comments made by defense counsel during summation. The court wrote, the Supreme Court identified eight specific statements made by defense counsel in its closing that the court characterized as improper, in addition to other remarks. However, none of these statements were objected to. We recognize that common courtesy requires an attorney allow opposing counsel the opportunity to argue his or her case without undue or repetitive interruptions. Nevertheless, where counsel in summing up exceeds the bounds of legal propriety, it is the duty of the opposing counsel to make a specific objection and for the court to rule on the objection, to direct the jury to disregard any improper remarks, and to admonish counsel from repetition of improper remarks. Where objection is not or cannot appropriately be interposed during summation, counsel should, upon the conclusion of the summation, make appropriate objections, seek curative instructions, or request a mistrial. Where no objection is interposed, a new trial may be directed only where the remarks are so prejudicial as to have caused a gross injustice, and where the comments are so pervasive, prejudicial, or inflammatory as to deprive a party of a fair trial. This standard was not met in this case. We stress that the plaintiff's counsel made no complaint regarding the allegedly prejudicial nature of the defendant's closing statement until after an adverse verdict was rendered. The verdict that the plaintiff did not sustain a serious injury was supported by the evidence, and the jury had ample reason to reject the plaintiff's claims and accept the arguments of the defendants. Next is the Ortega case. It's a traffic accident case, and it deals with the situation where the injured plaintiff has no memory of the accident. Second Department held that the motion to set aside the verdict in this traffic accident case was properly denied. Plaintiff had no memory of the accident and testified about his habit or routine practice of riding his bicycle home from work. The court had given the noseworthy jury instruction, which allows the jury to apply a lesser standard burden of proof where the plaintiff has no memory of the incident. The court wrote, "The plaintiff testified that while he didn't recall the accident, he did recall leaving work and getting on his bicycle with the intent of taking the route he usually took home, which route he detailed, explaining that he took the same route every day. While that route would have had the plaintiff traveling with traffic at the time of the accident, the defendant testified that the plaintiff was traveling against traffic. The jury could have credited the plaintiff's testimony as to his habit or routine practice, as to which the plaintiff submitted sufficient evidence to allow the inference of its persistence at the time of the accident, while also making reasonable inferences based on the defendant's own testimony that the defendant failed to see that which, through proper use of the driver's senses, she should have seen, for which the defendant could be found liable even if the plaintiff, as the defendant argues, could not establish he obeyed all the rules of the road." Next is the Carroll case. That's K-E-R-O-L-L-E. It's on page 40. It's an evidence case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case should have been granted. The defendant driver, whose name was Karen, made a statement included in the police report indicating she did not see plaintiff's motorcycle before the accident. In response to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, the driver, Karen, averred that she came to a stop at the stop sign, pulled out into the intersection, and then saw the motorcycle moving extremely fast. The Second Department held that the defendant had attempted to raise a feigned factual issue, and therefore her motion for summary judgment should have been denied. Next, on page 41, is the Contanzo case, traffic accident case, rear-end collision. Second Department held that the defendant in this traffic accident case failed to raise a question of fact about a non-negligent explanation for the rear-end collision. The defendant asserted that it appeared the lead vehicle and plaintiff's vehicle, which was behind the lead vehicle, were going to go through the yellow light at the intersection. The defendant asserted that the lead vehicle came to a sudden stop, plaintiff's vehicle struck the lead vehicle, and then defendant's vehicle struck the plaintiff's. The court held that the defendant should have anticipated the sudden stop because of the yellow light, and therefore the defendant had not presented a non-negligent explanation for the rear-end collision. Next is the Brodney case on page 42, another traffic accident case. Second Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case should not have been granted. Although plaintiff made out a prima facie case alleging the defendant, without warning, made a left turn in front of him in violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1141, defendant raised a question of fact about whether she violated the statute by averring that plaintiff was driving too fast. The court wrote, "The defendant driver averred that as she approached the intersection, she slowed her vehicle, activated her left-hand turn signal, and looked to ensure that the roadway was clear. As she was in process of turning, she noticed plaintiff's vehicle for the first time and observed it traveling toward her at such an excessive rate of speed that she was unable to avoid the impact. The foregoing was sufficient to raise a tribal issue of fact. And finally, on page 43 is the last case in this 2019 negligence update. It's a zone of danger case, the Green case. Second Department, over an extensive two-justice dissent, held that the grandmother of a two-year-old child who witnessed the child's death was not a member of the child's immediate family and therefore could not recover for negligent infliction of emotional distress, despite the grandmother's being in the zone of danger when the child was struck by falling pieces of a building facade. The motion to amend the complaint to add the negligent infliction of emotional distress cause of action should not have been granted. The court wrote, in Junqi Guan versus Tuscan Dairy Farms, 24 AD 3rd, 725, this court held that the relationship of grandparent and grandchild does not constitute immediate family so as to permit recovery for negligent infliction of emotional distress. In Junqi Guan, the plaintiff grandmother was pushing her infant grandson in a stroller when a truck owned and operated by the defendants struck the stroller, killing the infant. This court rejected the grandmother's argument that she should be considered immediate family because she was the family member who spent the most time with the infant during his waking hours. This court held that it is not appropriate for this court to expand the class of persons constituting immediate family, absent further direction from the Court of Appeals or the New York State Legislature. Okay, that completes this May 2019 Negligence Update CLE course, which is based on the summaries of cases released in May 2019 that were posted on the website New York Appellate Digest and have been compiled into the written materials for this course.